I understand. Damn. Well, he is confiding in me. Though that might be a clever ploy on Andrei Ilyich's part, mightn't it? But we are sure of it. Quite sure. How can I help? I need your help, Oleg. Again, I ask for it. This business with the Americans concerns you greatly, then? Of course it does. I can understand that it is something to be considered, but what real interest do they have in our domestic politics? You know the answer to that. True. I need your help, Narmonov repeated. I must discuss this with my colleagues. Quickly, if you please. Yes. Kadyshev took his leave and walked out to his car. He drove himself, which was unusual for a senior Soviet politician. Times had changed. Such officials now had to be men of the people, and that meant that the reserved center lanes of the broad Moscow streets were gone, along with most of the other traditional perks. That was too bad, Kadyshev thought. But without the other changes that made it necessary, he'd still be a lonely voice in some distant oblast, instead of the leader of a major faction in the Congress of People's Deputies. So he was willing to do without the dacha in the woods east of Moscow, and the luxury apartment, and the chauffeur-driven handmade limousine, and all the other things that had once attached to the rulers of this vast and unhappy country. He drove to his legislative office, where at least he had a reserved parking place. Once behind the closed door of his office, he composed a brief letter on his personal typewriter. This he folded into a pocket. There was work to do this day. He walked down the street to the immense lobby of the Congress and checked his coat. The attendant was female. She took his coat and handed him a numbered token. He thanked her politely. As she took the coat to its numbered hook, the attendant removed the note from the inside pocket and tucked it into the pocket of her own jacket. 4 hours later, it arrived in the American Embassy. Panic attack? Fellows asked. You might call it that, gentlemen, Ryan said. Okay. Tell us about the problem. Trent sipped at his tea. We've had more indications that our communications links may be penetrated. Again? Trent rolled his eyes. Come on, Al, we've heard that song before, Fellows grumbled. Details, Jack, details. Ryan went through the data. And what's the White House think?
I don't know yet. I'm heading up the street after I leave here. Frankly, I'd rather discuss it with you guys first, and I had to come down on some other stuff anyway. Jack went on to describe the Spinnaker report on Narmanov's problems.
How long have you had this?
A couple of weeks.
Why haven't we heard it? Trent demanded. Because we've been running around in circles trying to confirm it, Jack answered.
And?
Al, we've been unable to confirm directly. There are indications that the KGB is up to something. There seems to be a very discreet operation in Germany, looking for some lost tactical nukes.
Good Lord, Fellows noted. What do you mean by lost?
We're not sure. If it ties in with Spinnaker, well, maybe there's been some creative accounting on the part of the Soviet Army. Your opinion?
I don't know, guys. I just don't know.
Our analysis people are about evenly divided, those that are willing to offer an opinion.
We know their army isn't real happy, Fellows said slowly. The loss of funding, loss of prestige, loss of units and billets.
But that unhappy?
Pleasant thought, Trent added.
A power struggle in a country with all those nukes.
How reliable has Spinnaker been?
Very. 5 years of devoted service.
He's a member of their parliament, right? Fellows asked.
Correct.
Evidently a very senior one to get stuff like this.
That's okay. I don't think either one of us wants to know his name, Fellows added.
Trent nodded. Probably somebody we've met.
Good guess, Al, Jack didn't say.
You're taking this seriously also?
Yes, sir. And also trying very hard to confirm it.
Anything new on Nitaka? Trent asked.
Sir, I heard from up the street that there's something to do with Mexico, Al Trent said next. The president evidently wants my support on something.
You are cleared to tell us.
Honest, Jack, the president has authorized it. It was a technical rules violation, but Ryan had never known Trent to break his word. He went through that report also.
Those little bastards, Trent breathed. You know how many votes it cost me to roll over on that trade deal, and now they're planning to break it?
So you're saying we've been rolled again?
A possibility, sir.
Sam, the farmers in your district use all those nasty agricultural chemicals. Might cost 'em.
Al, free trade is an important principle, Fellows said.
So's keeping your goddamned word.
No argument, Al. Fellows started thinking about how many of his farmers might lose expected export income from a flip-flop on the deal that he'd fought for on the floor of the house.
How can we confirm this one?
Not sure yet.
Bug his airplane?
Trent suggested with a chuckle.
If we can confirm this, I'd like to be there when Fowler shoves it up his ass.
God damn it! I lost votes over this!
That he'd carried his district 58-42 was for the moment beside the point.
Well, the president wants us to back him up on this one.
Problems from your side of the aisle, Sam?
Probably not.
I'd just as soon stay clear of the political side of this, gentlemen. I'm just here as a messenger, remember?
Jack Ryan, last of the virgins.
Trent laughed.
Good report. Thanks for coming down.
Let us know if the president wants us to authorize the new and improved tap dance.
He'll never try. You're looking at 200 or 300 million bucks, and bucks are tight, Fellows noted.
I want to see better data before we spring for it. We've dropped too much money down these black holes.
All I can say, Congressman, is that I'm taking it very seriously.
So is the FBI.
And Ron Olson? Trent asked.
He's circling his wagons.
You'll have a better chance if he asks, Fellows told Ryan.
I know.
Well, at least we'll have our system up and running in 3 more weeks. We've started turning out the first set of disks and doing preliminary tests now.
How so?
We use a computer to look for non-randomness. The big one, the Cray YMP. We brought in a consultant from MIT's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory to do a new kind of type token program. In another week, 10 days call it, we'll know if the system is what we expect it to be. Then we'll start sending the hardware out.
I really hope you're wrong on this, Trent said as the meeting closed.
So do I, man. But my instincts say otherwise.
And how much is it going to cost? Fowler asked over lunch.
From what I gather, 200 or 300 million.
No. We've got budget problems enough.
I agree, Liz Elliott said. But I wanted to discuss it with you first. It's Ryan's idea. Olson at NSA says he's full of it, says the systems are secure. But Ryan's really crazed about this new encoding system. You know he pushed the same thing through for the agency. Even went to Congress directly.
Oh, really? Fowler looked up from his plate. He didn't go through OMB? What gives?
Bob, he delivered his pitch for the new NSA system to Trent and Fellows before he came to see me.
Who the hell does he think he is?
I keep telling you, Bob.
He's out, Elizabeth. Out. O-U-T. Get moving on it.
Okay. I think I know how to do it.
Circumstances made it easy. One of Ernest Wellington's investigators had been staking out the 7-Eleven for a week.
The Zimmer family business was just off U.S. Route 50 between Washington and Annapolis, and was adjacent to a large housing development from which it drew much of its business. The investigator parked his van at the end of a street that gave him both a view of the business building and the family house, which was only 50 yards away from it. The van was a typical covert surveillance vehicle, custom-built by one of several specialty firms. The roof vent concealed a sophisticated periscope, whose two lenses were connected respectively to a TV camera and a 35mm Canon. The investigator had a cooler full of soft drinks, a large thermos full of coffee, and a chemical toilet. He thought of the cramped van as his own personal space vehicle, and some of its high-tech gadgetry was at least as good as NASA had installed on the shuttle.
Bingo,
the radio crackled. Subject vehicle is taking the exit. Breaking off now. The man in the van lifted his own microphone. Roger. Out. Clark had noticed the Mercury 2 days earlier. One of the problems with commuting was that the same vehicles kept showing up from time to time, and he'd decided that's all it was. It never got close, and never followed them off the main road. In this case, as he took the exit, it didn't follow. Clark shifted his attention to other matters. He hadn't noticed that the guy was using a microphone, but those new cellular things had you talking into the visor, and wasn't technology wonderful? A good chase car need not tip himself off anymore. He pulled into the 7-Eleven parking lot, his eyes scanning for trouble. He saw none. Clark and Ryan exited the car at the same instant. Clark's top coat was unbuttoned, as was his suit jacket, the easier to allow access to the Beretta 10mm pistol riding on his right hip. The sun was setting, casting a lovely orange glow in the western sky, and it was unseasonably warm, shirt-sleeve weather that made him regret the raincoat he was wearing. D.C. area weather was as predictably unpredictable as anywhere in the world.
"Hello, Dr. Ryan," one of the Zimmer kids said. "Mom's over at the house."
"Okay." Ryan walked back outside and headed for the flagstone walk to the Zimmer residence. He spotted Carol in the back with her youngest on the new swing set. Clark trailed, alert as ever, seeing nothing but still green lawns and parked cars, a few kids throwing a football. Such temperate weather in the beginning of December worried Clark. He believed it heralded a bastard of a winter.
"Hi, Carol," Jack called.
Mrs. Zimmer was closely observing her youngest in the swing seat.
"Doc Ryan, you like the new swing set?"
Jack nodded a little guiltily. He should have helped get it together. He was an expert on assembling toys. He leaned over. "How's the little munchkin?"
"She won't get out, and it's dinner time," Carol said. "You help?"
"How's everyone else?"
"Peter accepted in college, too. Full scholarship MIT."
"Great." Jack gave her a congratulatory hug. "What's the old joke? The doctor is 5 and the lawyer is 3.
God.
Wouldn't Buck be proud of how these kids are turning out?" It was little more than the normal Asian obsession with education, of course, the same thing that had stood Jewish Americans in such good stead. If an opportunity presents itself, grab it by the throat. He bent down to the newest Zimmer, who held her arms up for her Uncle Jack. "Come on, Jackie." He picked her up and got a kiss for his trouble. Ryan looked up when he heard the noise.
Gotcha.
It's a simple trick, and an effective one. Even if you know it's coming, you can't do much to prevent it. The van had several buttons which, when pressed, beeped the horn. It was a sound the human brain recognized as a danger signal, and one instinctively looked toward whatever direction it had come from to see if there was any cause for concern. The investigator hit the nearest one, and sure enough, Ryan looked up toward the sound with an armful of kid. He'd caught the hug for the woman and the kiss from the kid, and now he had a full-face shot on the 1200-speed film in his camera to back up the videotape. That simple. He had the goods on this Ryan guy. Amazing that a man with such a lovely wife would feel the need to screw around. But that was life, wasn't it? A CIA bodyguard to keep everything nice and secure. The kid involved, too. What a shit, the man thought, as the motor drive whirred away on the cannon.
You stay for dinner. This time you stay. We celebrate Peter's scholarship.
Can't say no to that one, Doc, Clark observed. Okay. Ryan carried Jacqueline Teresa Zimmer into the house. Neither he nor Clark noticed that the van parked 50 yards away pulled off a few minutes later. It was the most delicate part of the process. The plutonium was set into cerium sulfide ceramic crucibles. The crucibles were carried to the electric furnace. Frome closed and locked the door. A vacuum pump evacuated the enclosure and replaced argon.
Air has oxygen, Frome explained. Argon is an inert gas. We take no chances. Plutonium is highly reactive and pyrophoric. The ceramic crucibles are also inert and non-reactive. We use more than one crucible to avoid the possibility of forming a critical mass and starting a premature atomic reaction.
The phase transformations, Gone asked.
Correct. How long?
This question from Kati.
2 hours. We take our time in this part. On removal from the furnace, the crucibles will be covered, of course, and we make the pour in an inert gas enclosure. Now you know why we needed this sort of furnace.
No danger when you make the pour? Frome shook his head.
None at all, so long as we are careful. The configuration of the mold absolutely prevents forming a critical mass. I've done this many times in simulation. There have been accidents, but those invariably involved larger masses of fissile material and took place before all the hazards of handling plutonium were fully understood. No, we will move slowly and carefully.
Pretend it is gold, Frome concluded.
The machining process. 3 weeks, and 2 more of assembly and testing of the components.
The tritium extraction? Gone asked.
Frome bent down to look into the furnace.
I'll do that right before completion, and that will conclude the exercise.
See any resemblance? The investigator asked.
Hard to tell, Wellington thought.
In any case, he sure seems to like the little tyke.
Cute enough.
I watched them build the swing set last weekend. The little one... Name's Jackie, by the way. Jacqueline Teresa.
Oh, that's interesting.
Wellington made a note. Anyway, the little one loves the damn thing. Seems right fond of Mr. Ryan also.
You suppose he really is the father?
Possible, Wellington said, watching the videotape and comparing the picture there with the still shots. Light wasn't very good. I can have the backroom boys enhance it. Take a few days for the tape, though. They have to do it frame by frame.
I think that's a good idea.
We want this to be solid.
It will be.
So what's going to happen to him?
He'll be encouraged to leave government service, I suppose.
You know, if we were private citizens, you might call this blackmail, invasion of privacy.
But we're not, and it isn't. This guy holds a security clearance, and it appears that his personal life isn't what it should be.
Well, I suppose that's not our fault, is it?
Exactly.
Chapter 22. Repercussions.
Damn it, Ryan, you can't do that.
Do what? Jack responded.
You went over my head to the hill.
What do you mean?
All I did was suggest to Trent and Fellows that there might be a problem. I'm supposed to do that.
It's not confirmed, the director insisted.
So whatever is fully confirmed?
Look at this. Cabot handed over a new file. This is Spinnaker.
Why haven't I seen it yet?
Just read it, Cabot snapped back.
Confirms the leak.
It was a short one, and Jack raced through it.
Except he thinks it's a leak in the Moscow embassy. like a code clerk, maybe. Pure speculation on his part. All he really says is that he wants his reports transported by hand now. That's the only definite thing this tells us.
Cabot dodged. I know we've done that before.
Yes, we have, Ryan admitted. It would even be easier now with the direct air service from New York to Moscow.
What's the rat line look like now?
Ryan frowned at that. Cabot liked to use agency jargon, though the term rat line, meaning the chain of people and methods that transported a document from agent to case officer, had actually gone out of favor.
It's a fairly simple one.
Kadyshev leaves his messages in a coat pocket. The checkroom attendant at their congress retrieves the messages and gets them off to one of our people by brush pass. Simple and direct. Also rather fast. I've never been comfortable with it, but it works.
So now we have two top agents who are unhappy with our communication systems, and I have to fly all the way to Japan, personally, to meet with one.
It's not all that unusual for an agent to want to meet a high agency official director. These people get twitchy, and knowing that some higher up cares about them is what they need.
It'll waste a whole week of my time, Cabot objected.
You have to go to Korea in late January anyway, Ryan pointed out. Catch our friend on the way back. He's not demanding to see you immediately, just soon. Ryan returned to the Spinnaker report, wondering why Cabot allowed himself to be sidetracked by irrelevancies. The reason, of course, was that the man was a dilettante, and a lazy one, who disliked losing arguments. The new report said that Narmanov was very worried indeed that the West would find out just how desperate his situation with the Soviet military and KGB was. There was no further information on missing nuclear weapons, but plenty on new changes in parliamentary loyalties. The report gave Ryan the impression of having been slapped together. He decided to have Mary Pat look at it. Of all the people in the agency, she was the only one who really understood the guy.
I presume you're taking it to the president.
Yes, I think I have to.
If I may make a suggestion, remember to tell him that we have not really confirmed anything Kadyshev has said.
Cabot looked up.
So?
So it's true, Director. When you single-source something, especially something that's apparently highly important, you tell people that.
I believe this guy.
I'm not so sure.
The Russian department buys it, Cabot noted.
True, they've signed off on it. But I'd feel a hell of a lot better if we had independent confirmation, Jack said.
Do you have any firm basis to doubt this information?
Nothing I can show to you, no. It's just that we ought to have been able to confirm something by now.
So you expect me to go all the way down to the White House, present this, and then admit that it might be wrong?
Cabot stamped out his cigar, much to Jack's relief.
Yes, sir.
I won't do that.
You have to do that, sir. You have to do that because it happens to be true. It's the rule.
Jack, it can get slightly tedious when you tell me what the rules of this place are. I am the director, you know.
Look, Marcus, Ryan said, trying to keep the exasperation out of his voice. What we have with this guy is some really hot information, something which, if true, could affect the way we deal with the Soviets. But it is not confirmed. It just comes from one person, okay? What if he's wrong? What if he misunderstands something? What if he's lying, even?
Do we have any reason to believe that?
None at all, Director. But on something this important, is it prudent or reasonable to affect our government's policy on the basis of a short letter from a single person?
That was always the best way to get to Marcus Cabot. Prudence and reason.
I hear what you're saying, Jack.
Okay. My car is waiting. I'll be back in a couple of hours.
Cabot grabbed his coat and walked out to the executive elevator. His agency car was waiting. As director of Central Intelligence, he got a pair of bodyguards, one driving and the other in the front passenger seat. Otherwise, he had to deal with traffic the same as everyone else.
Ryan, he thought on the drive down the George Washington Parkway, was becoming a pain in the ass. Okay, so he himself was new here. Okay, so he was inexperienced. Okay, so he liked to leave day-to-day stuff to his subordinates. He was the director, after all, and didn't need to deal with every little damn thing. He was getting tired of having the rules of conduct explained to him once or twice a week. Tired of having Ryan go over his head. Tired of having analysis explained to him every time something really juicy came in. By the time he entered the White House, Cabot was quite annoyed. "Morning, Marcus," Liz Elliott said in her office. "Good morning. We have another Spinnaker report. President needs to go over it."
"So, what's Kadyshev up to?"
"Who told you his name?" the DCI growled.
"Ryan. Didn't you know?"
"God damn it," Cabot swore. "He didn't tell me that." "Sit down, Marcus. We have a few minutes. How happy are you with Ryan? Sometimes he forgets who's the director and who's the deputy. He is a little on the arrogant side, isn't he?"
"Slightly," Cabot agreed frostily. "He's good at what he does, within limitations. But personally, I'm getting a little tired of his attitude."
"I know what you mean. He likes telling me what I have to do. With this, for example."
"Oh?
He doesn't trust your judgment?" the National Security Advisor asked, selecting her needle with care. Cabot looked up. "Yeah, that's the attitude he conveys."
"Well,
we weren't able to change everything from the previous administration. Of course, he is a pro at this." Her voice trailed off. "And I'm not," Cabot demanded.
"Of course you are, Marcus. You know I never meant it that way."
"Sorry, Liz. You're right. Sometimes he rubs me the wrong way, that's all.
Let's go see the boss."
"How solid is this?" President Fowler asked 5 minutes later. "As you've already heard, this agent has been working for us over 5 years, and his information has invariably been accurate. Have you confirmed it?"
"Not completely," Cabot replied.
"It's unlikely that we can, but our Russian department believes it, and so do I." Ryan had his doubts. Cabot was getting a little tired of hearing about Ryan. "I do not, Mr. President. I think Ryan is trying to impress us with his new views on the Soviet government, trying to show us that he's not a cold warrior anymore." Again, Cabot had dwelt on irrelevancies, Elliot thought to herself. Fowler's eyes shifted. "Elizabeth?"
"It's certainly plausible that the Soviet security apparatus is trying to stake out an improved position." Her voice purred at its most reasonable timbre. "They're unhappy with the liberalization. They're unhappy with their loss of power. And they're unhappy with what they think is a failure of leadership on Narmanov's part. This information, therefore, is consistent with a lot of other facts we have. I think we should believe it."
"If this is true, then we have to ease off on our support for Narmanov. We cannot be party to a reversion to more centralized rule, particularly if it results from elements who so clearly dislike us."
"Agreed," Liz said. "Better to lose Narmanov. If he can't break their military to his will, then someone else will have to. Of course, we have to give him a fair chance. How we do that is rather tricky. We don't want to dump the country into the hands of their military, do we?"
"Are you kidding?" Fowler observed. They stood on a catwalk inside the massive boat shed where the Trident submarines were prepared for sea, watching the crew of USS Georgia load up for their next cruise. "Talked his way out of it, Bart?" Jones asked. "His explanation made a lot of sense, Ron.
When's the last time you caught me wrong?"
"For all things, there is a first time."
"Not this one, Skipper," Dr. Jones said quietly. "I got a feeling."
Okay. I want you to spend some more time on the simulator with his sonar troops.
Fair enough. Jones was quiet for a few seconds.
You know, it might be fun to go out just one more time.
Mancuso turned.
Are you volunteering?
No.
Kim might not understand my being away for 3 months. 2 weeks is long enough. Too long, as a matter of fact. I'm getting very domesticated, Bart. Getting old and respectable. Not young and bright-eyed like those kids.
What do you think of them?
The sonar guys? They're good. So's the tracking party. The guy Rick's replaced was Jim Roselli, right?
That's right.
He trained them well.
Can we go off the record?
Sure.
Rick's is not a good skipper. He's too tough on the troops, demands too much, too hard to satisfy.
Not like you were at all, Bart.
Mancuso dodged the compliment.
We all have different styles.
I know that.
But I wouldn't want to sail with him.
One of his chiefs asked for a transfer off. So did half a dozen petty officers.
They all had family problems.
Mancuso had approved all the transfers, including the young chief torpedo man.
No, they didn't, Jones said. They needed excuses, and they used them.
Ron, look. I'm the squadron commander, okay? I can only evaluate my COs on the basis of performance. Ricks didn't get here by being a loser.
You look from the top down. I look from the bottom up. From my perspective, this man is not a good skipper.
I wouldn't say that to anybody else. But we were shipmates.
Okay, I was a peon, just a lowly E6, but you never treated me that way. You were a good boss.
Ricks isn't.
The crew doesn't like him, does not have confidence in him.
Damn it, Ron. I can't allow stuff like that to affect my judgment.
Yeah, I know. Annapolis, old school tie.
Ring, whatever matters to you, canoe you grads. You have to approach it a different way.
Like I said, I wouldn't talk this way with anybody else. If I was on that boat, I'd try to transfer off.
I sailed with some skippers I didn't like. It's mainly a matter of style.
You say so, Commodore?
Jones paused.
Just remember one thing, okay?
There's lots of ways to impress a senior officer. But there's only one way to impress a crew.
Frome insisted that they take their time. The mold had long since cooled and was now broken open in the inert atmosphere of the first machine tool. The roughly formed metal mass was set in place. Frome personally checked the computer codes that told the machine what it had to do and punched the first button. The robotic system activated. The moving arm selected the proper tool head, secured it on the rotating spindle, and maneuvered itself into place. The enclosed area was flooded with argon gas, and Freon began spraying on the plutonium to keep everything to the proper isothermal heat environment. Frome touched the computer screen, selecting the initial program. The spindle started turning, reaching over 1,000 RPM, and approached the plutonium mass with a motion that was neither human nor mechanistic, but something else entirely, like a caricature of a man's action. As they watched from behind the Lexan shield, the first shavings of the silvery metal thread peeled off the main mass.
How much are we losing? Gone asked.
Oh, the total will be less than 20 grams, Frome estimated. It's nothing to worry about.
Frome looked at another gauge, the one that measured relative pressures. The machine tool was totally isolated from the rest of the room, with the pressure inside its enclosure marginally less than outside. The fact that argon gas was heavier than air would keep oxygen away from the plutonium. That prevented possible combustion. Combustion would generate plutonium dust, which was every bit as lethal as Frome had told them. A toxic heavy metal, the additional hazard of radioactivity, mainly low-energy alphas, merely made death more rapid and marginally less pleasant. The machinists moved in to take over supervision of the process. They had worked out extremely well, Frome thought. The skills they'd brought with them had grown with remarkable speed under his tutelage.
They were nearly as good as the men he'd trained in Germany, despite their lack of formal education. There was much to be said for practical instead of theoretical work.
How long? Kati asked. How many times do I have to tell you? We are precisely on schedule. This phase of the project is the most time-consuming. The product we are now producing must be perfect. Absolutely perfect. If this part of the device fails to function, nothing else will.
That's true of everything we've done,
Gone pointed out.
Correct, my young friend, but this is the easiest thing to get wrong. The metal is hard to work, and the metallic phase transformations make it all the more delicate. Now, let's see those explosive blocks.
Gone was right. Everything had to work. The explosives had been almost entirely his problem after Frome had set the design specifications. They'd taken normal TNT and added a stiffener, a plastic that made the material quite rigid, but without affecting its chemical properties. Normally, explosives are plastic and easily malleable by their nature. That property had to be eliminated, since the shape of the blocks was crucial to the way in which their explosive energy was delivered. Gone had shaped 600 such blocks, each a segment of a full ellipsoid. 70 of them would nest together exactly, forming an explosive ring with an outside diameter of 35 centimeters. Each block had a squib fired from Kryton switches. The wires leading from the power supply to the switches all had to be of exactly the same length. Frome lifted one of the blocks.
You say that these are all identical? Frome asked.
Completely. I followed your directions exactly.
Pick 70 at random. I'll take one of the stainless steel blanks, and we will test your work.
The spot was already prepared, of course. It was, in fact, the eroded crater from an American-made Mark 84 bomb dropped by an Israeli F-4 Phantom some years before. Kati's men had erected a prefabricated structure of timber posts and beams whose roof was three layers of sandbags. Camouflage netting had been added to reduce the chance of notice. Test assembly took 3 hours, and an electronic strain gauge was inserted in the steel blank and a wire run to the next crater down, 200 meters away, where Frome waited with an oscilloscope. They were finished just before dusk.
Ready, Gone said.
Proceed, Frome replied, concentrating on his scope. Ibrahim pressed the button. The structure disintegrated before their eyes. A few sandbags survived, flying through the air, but mainly there was a shower of dirt. On the O-scope, the peak pressure was frozen in place well before the crump of the blast wave passed over their heads. Bach and Kati were somewhat disappointed in the physical effects of the explosion, most of which had been attenuated by the sandbags. Was such a small detonation enough to ignite a nuclear device?
Well,
Gone asked as a man ran off to the newly deepened crater.
10% off, Frome said, looking up.
Then he smiled.
10% too much. What does that mean?
Kati demanded, suddenly worried that they'd done something wrong.
It means that my young student has learned his lessons well.
15 minutes later, they were sure. It took 2 men to find it, and half an hour to remove the tungsten casing from the core. What had been a nearly solid steel mass as big around as a man's fist was now a distorted cylinder no wider than a cigar. Had it been plutonium, a nuclear reaction would have taken place. Of that, the German was sure. Frome hefted it in his hand and presented it to Ibrahim.
Herr Gone, he said formally, you have a gift with explosives. You are a fine engineer. In the DDR, it took us 3 attempts to get it right. You have done it in 1.
How many more?
Frome nodded.
Very good. We shall do another tomorrow. We will test all the stainless steel blanks, of course.
That is why we made them,
Gone agreed. On the way back, Bach ran over his own calculations. According to Frome, the force of the final explosion would be more than 450,000 tons of TNT. He therefore based his estimates on a mere 400,000. Bach was always conservative on casualty estimates. The stadium and all in it would be vaporized. No, he corrected himself. That wasn't really true. There was nothing magical about this weapon. It was merely a large explosive device. The stadium and all in it would be totally destroyed, but there would be a great deal of rubble flung ballistically hundreds, perhaps thousands of meters. The ground nearest the device would be pulverized down to pieces of molecular size. Dust particles would then be sucked up into the fireball. Bits of the bomb assembly residue would affix themselves to the rising, boiling dust. That's what fallout was, he'd learned. Dirt with bomb residue attached. The nature of the blast, being set off at ground level, would maximize the fallout, which would be borne downwind. The majority would fall within 30 kilometers of the blast site. The remainder would be a plaything of the winds, to fall over Chicago or St. Louis or maybe even Washington. How many would die from that? Good question. He estimated roughly 200,000 from the blast itself, certainly no more than that. Another 50 to 100,000 from secondary effects, that number including long-term deaths from cancers which would take years to manifest themselves. As Kati had noted earlier, the actual death count was somewhat disappointing. It was so easy to think of nuclear bombs as magical engines of destruction, but they were not. They were merely highly powerful bombs with some interesting secondary effects. It also made for the finest terrorist weapon yet conceived. Terrorist, Bach asked himself. Is that what I am? It was, of course, in the eye of the beholder. Bach had long since decided his measure of respect for the judgment of others. This event would be the best expression of it. John, I need an idea, Ryan said. What's that? Clark asked. I've drawn a blank. The Japanese Prime Minister is going to be in Mexico in February, then he's flying up here to see the President. We want to know what he's going to be saying on his airplane. I don't have the legs to dress up as a stew, Doc. Besides, I've never learned to do the tea ceremony either. The field officer turned SPO, paused, and turned serious. Bug an airplane? That sounds like a real technical challenge. What do you know about this? John examined his coffee. I've placed intelligence-gathering devices before, but always on the ground. With an aircraft, you have lots of ambient noise to worry about. You also have to sweat where your subject intends to sit. Finally, with the presidential aircraft, you need to worry about security. The technical side is probably the hardest, he decided. The greatest personal threat to the guy is probably at home. Unless he's going to stop over at Detroit, right? Mexico City. Okay, people speak Spanish there, and my Spanish is pretty good. I'd take Ding down with me, of course. What sort of aircraft will he be using? I checked. He'll be flying a JAL 747. The upper deck behind the cockpit is laid out as his conference room. They put in beds, too. That's where he'll be. Their PM likes to kibitz with the drivers. He's pretty smart about traveling, sleeps as much as he can to handle the jet lag. Clark nodded. People have to wipe the windows. Not like he's got an Air Force base to handle all the ground service requirements like we do it. If JAL flies into there regularly, they'll have Mexican ground crews. I'll check out data on the 747. Like I said, that's the easy part. I can probably talk my way there. Might even get Ding to head down with a good set of papers and get a job. That would make it easier. I presume this has executive approval? The president said, find a way. He'll have to approve the final op plan. I need to talk to the S&T guys. Clark referred to the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology. The real problem is noise. How fast, Doc? Fast, John. Okay. Clark rose. Gee, I get to be a field spook again. I'll be over in the new building. It may take me a few days to figure if it's possible or not. This means I can't go on the UK trip?
Bother you? Jack asked.
Nope. Just as soon stay home.
Fair enough.
I get to do some Christmas shopping at Hamley's.
You know how lucky you are to have them, Little.
All my girls want now is clothes, and I can't pick girl clothes worth a damn.
Clark lived in horror of buying women's clothing.
Sally has her doubts now, but Little Jack still believes.
Clark shook his head.
After you stop believing in Santa Claus, the whole world just goes downhill.
Ain't it the truth?
Chapter 23. Opinions.
Jack, you look bloody awful,
Sir Basil Charleston observed.
If one more person tells me that, I'm gonna waste him.
Bad flight.
Bumpy as hell all the way across. Didn't sleep much, as the even darker than usual circles under his eyes proclaimed.
Well, we'll see if lunch helps.
It is a pretty day, Ryan noted as they walked up Westminster Bridge Road toward Parliament. It was a rare early winter English day with a blue, cloudless sky. A brisk wind swept down the Thames, but Ryan didn't mind. He had a heavy coat and a scarf around his neck, and the frigid blast on his face woke him up.
Trouble at the office, Baz.
Found a bug. A bloody bug 2 floors down from my office. The whole building's being swept.
Things are tough all over. KGB?
Not sure, Charleston said as they crossed the bridge.
Trouble with the facade, you see. Bloody thing began crumbling. Same as happened to Scotland Yard a few years ago. The workers replacing it found an unexplained wire and followed it. Our Russian friends have not cut back on their activities, and there are other services as well.
See anything like that in your shop?
No.
It helps that we're more isolated than Century House. Jack meant that the British Secret Intelligence Service was in so densely populated an area. There was a nearby apartment block, for example, that a very low-power bug could get data out. That was less likely at the agency's Langley headquarters, which sat alone on a large wooded campus. In addition to that, the newer construction had allowed installation of elaborate protections against internal radio sources.
You should do what we've done and install waveguides.
That would cost a bloody fortune, which we do not have at the moment.
What the hell? It gives us a chance to take a walk. If anyone can bug us out here, we've already lost.
It never ends, does it?
We win the Cold War, but it never, ever ends.
Which Greek was it?
The one whose personal hell was rolling a big rock up a hill? And every time he got it there, the son of a bitch rolled down the other side.
Sisyphus? Tantalus, perhaps.
Long time since I bade farewell to Oxford, Sir John. In either case, you're right. Get to the top of one hill, and all you see is another damned hill.
They continued walking down the embankment away from Parliament, but toward lunch. Meetings like this one had rules. You couldn't get down to business until after the small talk and a pregnant pause. In this case, there were some off-season American tourists snapping pictures. Charleston and Ryan walked around to avoid them.
We have a problem, Baz.
What's that?
Charleston said without turning. Behind them were 3 security officers. 2 more preceded them. Jack didn't turn either.
We have a guy inside the Kremlin. Spends some time with Narmanov. Says Andrei Ilyich is worried about a military KGB coup. Says that they might renege on the Strategic Arms Treaty. Also says that some tactical nuclear devices may be missing from their inventories in Germany.
Indeed.
That's cheery news.
How good is your source?
Extremely good.
Well, I can only say it's news to me, Dr. Ryan.
How good is your guy? Jack asked.
Quite good.
Nothing like this?
Some rumbles, of course. I mean, Narmanov does have a full plate, doesn't he?
Ever since that dreadful affair with the Balts and the Georgians and his Muslims.
What is it you Yanks say? One-armed paper hanger?
He's that busy and more. He's had to make a deal with his security forces. But a coup d'etat?
Charleston shook his head.
No, the tea leaves don't appear that way to us.
That's precisely what our agent is telling us. What about the nuclear thing?
I'm afraid our chap isn't well-placed for that sort of information. More the civilian side, you see.
And that, Jack knew, was as far as Basil would go.
How seriously are you taking this?
Very seriously. I have to. This agent has been giving us good stuff for a lot of years.
One of Mrs. Foley's recruits, Charleston asked with a chuckle. What a marvelous young lady. I understand she recently delivered another child.
Little girl, Emily Sarah. Looks just like her mom. Jack thought he'd dodged the first question rather adroitly. Mary Pat will be back at work right after New Year.
Ah, yes. You do have that fortress nursery on your grounds, don't you?
One of the smartest investments we ever made. Wish I'd thought of it.
You Americans. Sir Basil laughed. Missing nuclear weapons.
Yes, I suppose one must take that very seriously indeed. Possible collusion between the army and KGB and a tactical nuclear trump.
Quite frightening, I must say.
But we have not heard a whisper. Rather a difficult secret to keep, wouldn't you say? I mean, blackmail doesn't work terribly well unless people know they're being blackmailed.
We've also caught a rumble that KGB is running some nuclear-oriented operation in Germany.
That's all, just a rumble.
Yes, we've heard that too,
Charleston said as they turned to walk down the brow to the Tattersall Castle, an old paddle steamer long since converted to a restaurant.
And? And we've run our own op. It seems that Eric Honecker had his own little Manhattan project underway. Fortunately, it died in the womb. Ivan was quite upset to learn of it. The DDR returned a goodly supply of plutonium to their former socialist colleagues just before the change. I speculate that KGB is investigating the same thing.
Why didn't you tell us?
Jesus, Baz, Jack thought. You guys just don't forget, do you?
Nothing to tell, Jack. Charleston nodded at the headwaiter, who took them to a table well aft. The security officers situated themselves between their charges and the rest of luncheon in humanity. Our German friends have been very forthcoming. The project, they say, has been quashed, completely and for all time. We've had our technical people over everything, and they confirmed everything our German colleagues told us.
When was this?
Several months ago.
Ever eat here, Jack? Charleston asked as the waiter appeared.
Not this one. A few of the other ferry boats. Basil ordered a pint of bitter. Jack decided on a lager. They watched the waiter withdraw.
The KGB op is more recent.
Interesting. Could be the same thing, you know. Could be that they had the same interests we had and were just a little slower to move.
On nukes? Ryan shook his head. Our Russian friends are pretty smart, Bass, and they pay much closer attention to nuclear issues than we do. It's one of the things I admire about them.
Yes, they did learn their lesson from China, didn't they? Charleston set his menu down and waved to the waiter to bring the drinks.
You think this is a serious matter, then?
Sure do.
Your judgment is generally rather good, Jack.
Thank you, Basil told the waiter. Both men made their orders.
You think we should poke about?
I think that might be a good idea.
Very well. What else can you tell me?
I'm afraid that's it, Bass.
Your source must be very good indeed.
Sir Basil sipped at his beer.
I think you have reservations.
I do, but... Hell, Basil, when do we not have reservations?
Any contrary data?
None, just that we've been totally unable to confirm. Our source is good enough that we may not be able to confirm elsewhere. That's why I came over.
Your guy must be pretty good, too, judging by what you've sent us.
Whoever he is, he might be the best chance to back our guy up. And if we can't confirm, then probably we'll go with it anyway. Ryan didn't like that. And your reservations probably don't matter. Two reasons. Number one, I'm not sure myself whether to sign off on this or not. Number two, not everyone cares what I think. And that's why you've not received credit for your work on the treaty. Ryan grinned rather tiredly, having not had much sleep in the preceding 36 hours. I refuse to be surprised by that, and I won't ask how you pulled that one out of the hat. But I wish somebody would leak it to the press or something. Ryan allowed himself a laugh. I'm afraid we don't do that here. I've only leaked it to one person. PM? His Royal Highness. You are having dinner with him tonight, correct? I reckoned he might like to know. Jack thought about that. The Prince of Wales wouldn't let it go any further. Ryan could never have told him. But thanks, pal. We all crave recognition in one way or another. You and I are both denied it as a matter of course. Not really fair, but there you are. In this case, I broke one of my own rules, and if you ask why, I'll tell you. What you did was bloody marvelous, Jack. If there were justice in the world, Her Majesty would enter you in the Order of Merit. You can't tell her, Basil. She just might do it all on her own. She might indeed. And that would let out the little secret, mightn't it? Dinner arrived, and they had to wait again. It wasn't just me. You know that Charlie Alden did a lot of good work. So did Talbot, Bunker, Scott Adler, a bunch of others. Your modesty is as comprehensive as ever, Dr. Ryan. Does that mean stupid, Baz? Ryan got a smile instead of an answer. The Brits were good at that. Frome would never have believed it. They'd made 5 stainless steel blanks to duplicate the size and configuration of the plutonium. Gone had made all the necessary explosive blocks. They'd tested the explosives on all 5 blanks, and in every case the explosives had done their job. This was one very talented young man. Of course, he'd had exact plans to follow, and Frome had generated them with the help of a fine computer, but even so, getting something so difficult right the first time was hardly the norm in engineering. The plutonium was now through the first part of the machining process. It actually looked rather good, like a high-quality steel forging machine to be part of an automotive engine. That was a good beginning. The robot arm of the milling machine removed the plutonium from its spindle and set it in an enclosed box. The box was, of course, filled with argon gas. The arm sealed it and moved to a door. Then Frome removed it from the machine enclosure and walked over to the air-bearing lathe. The process was reverse duplicated. He slid the box into the enclosure. Vacuum pumps were activated, and while the air was sucked out the top of the enclosure, argon gas was added at the bottom. When the internal atmosphere was totally inert, the robot arm of this tool opened the box and extracted the plutonium. The next programmed set of movements set it precisely on a new spindle. The degree of precision was hugely important. Under Frome's supervision, the spindle was activated, building its speed up slowly to 15,000 RPM. It would appear that... No! Frome swore. He'd thought he'd gotten it perfect. The spindle slowed back down and a tiny adjustment was made. Frome took his time checking the balance, then powered it up again. This time it was perfect. He took the RPMs all the way to 25,000, and there was no jitter at all. Your man did the first machining very nicely, Frome said over his shoulder. How much mass did we lose? Gone asked. 18.527 grams. Frome switched the spindle off and stood. I can scarcely praise our workers enough. I suggest that we wait until tomorrow to begin final polishing. It is foolish to rush about. We are all tired,
and I think dinner is called for. As you say, Herr Fromm.
Manfred, the German said, surprising the younger man. Ibrahim, we must talk. Outside? Gon led the German out the door. Night was falling.